all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am the officer of the deck, Jim Fossone, today here on WAM 1600 AM Talk Radio. We're thrilled to have you along and to talk about some of the issues of interest to our veterans as we come into the holiday season. We've got a couple of good interviews I think you'll enjoy. One is both kind of local, but one is more local than the other, I suppose. So we're going to talk about a couple of Navy veterans who started up a friendship that blossomed further into a business opportunity called Galley Group. And it's an interesting food restaurant concept that is making its way through the Midwest, started in the Pittsburgh area, moving to Cleveland, Chicago, and coming to Detroit. So you'll find this of interest and in possibly a place where you can go out and enjoy some dining next year. We're then going to also talk with local author John U. Bacon. Many of you in the greater Ann Arbor area know him for his sports writing and books he's written in that regards. But what you may not know is that he's also written a book on a World War explosion called the Great Halifax Explosion. And I think you'll find this of interest, and you'll see ripples from his book through the war in Europe, as well as some things that even echo down till today. So sit back, enjoy listening to Veterans Radio here on WAAM Ann Arbor.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Tyler Benson, a Navy veteran who's got a very unique business we look forward to talking about. Tyler, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's start with a little background material. I know you grew up in some time in Seattle and in Texas. Tell us about how you found your way into the Navy.
It was a winding path into the Navy. My father's actually a pilot. He was not a military pilot. He's an airline pilot. We moved from Seattle to Dallas, Texas, when I was a teenager, and I went to high school there. And along the way, decided I wanted to go into the military. I actually considered the Air Force for a while, decided to go Navy, which I'm very happy about, and applied for ROTC. So I ended up going to the University of Michigan on a Naval ROTC scholarship.
And talk a little bit about your ROTC experience.
I think ROTC is one of the best opportunities out there in the military in general to receive an education to earn a commission into any of the armed forces. And I think it was a great experience. You know, you have OCS, you have ROTC, and then you have the academies. Those are three ways that you can earn a commission in the military. I think that ROTC provides an amazing balance between having a semi-normal college experience and college life and still receiving the training that you need to become an officer, to serve in the fleet.
So where did you first get assigned after you get commissioned?
Well, I commissioned, and then the process is that you select you don't really select anything as an ensign. Things get selected for you. But I requested a ship out in San Diego. It's the USS Cape St. George as a cruiser. And just based on how the commissioning cycle kind of fell, I was commissioned in April. We were outside of the cycle of the academy graduates. So most of us got our first choice. Just because we were a few days early, in the process. So I did get the Cape St. George. It's a guided missile cruiser CG-71 out in San Diego. And I commissioned end of April, and 3 weeks later I stepped aboard the ship. Had no idea what job I was going to have. And they kind of just throw you into it. That's the surface warfare community that I was a part of.
And it was exciting. Just to give our Army friends and listeners here on Veterans Radio a little idea, that cruiser is about 567 feet long, has a complement of 33 officers, 27, I think, chief petty officers, something like 340 enlisted.
That's exactly right. It's a big crew, but after a few months at sea, everybody becomes pretty close. So it is one of the larger ships in the surface warfare community outside the aircraft carrier. We're the main I guess you could say protector of the aircraft carrier. That was kind of our mission. We followed the Abraham Lincoln all around the world and provided air support and air defense for their missions.
To another assignment. Tell us about that.
I did. So at the end of your first tour, you get to, again, make a request for a ship you wanted to go to. I wanted to try a different side of the Navy. So I requested to be on an amphib, short for amphibious ship. The ship itself is not amphibious, but it launches amphibious craft from it. It was the USS Harper's Ferry. That's LSD-49. And our mission was to take Marines over to the Arabian Gulf and conduct training exercises.
So, as they say, you join the Navy and see the world. You really did get a chance to do that, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. On my first ship, Cape St. George, we actually did a circumnavigation. So we left San Diego. We skipped Hawaii, which everybody was a little bit upset about. We continued on to Thailand. We went through the Indian Ocean. Then we spent 6 months in the Arabian Gulf. And then we had the chance to go to transit the Red Sea and go through the Suez Canal, transit the Med, stop in Malta, transit the Straits of Gibraltar, cross the Atlantic, did a port call in Key West, transited the Caribbean, went through the Panama Canal, which is one of those experiences that I'll remember forever, and then run up the coast of western Mexico back to San Diego. So it took about almost 10 months, and it was an amazing experience.
And the seas were always flat, and the wind was always at your back, wasn't it?
I wish. It would have been more like a cruise.
So did you obtain your MBA from the Kelley School of Business at Indiana University while you were on sea duty?
Yeah, I did. And a lot of people don't believe me when I tell them that. I did. I pushed through it, and I had a lot of great classmates. A lot of the work you do in business school is team-oriented, and there were a few months there that overlapped with deployment, and I just had some really great teams that helped me through those times. When we were in port, it was 20-hour days. I'd get off the ship, 12 to 15-hour days, and go home and study for 3 or 4 hours, 7 days a week. You could ask my wife how that was for everybody, but it was only with a supportive network and supportive family that was even possible. So we pushed through and got it done.
Well, I think that's really good advice for people who are still on active duty, who are thinking about, geez, do I do it now or do I do it later? Even if you do some of it while on active duty, you're getting yourself ahead of the game. And that's what you were trying to do, wasn't it, Tyler?
Absolutely. And you can always, as you said, you can get started. You can take class here and there just to keep yourself in the game and keep your mind active. If it's something you want to pursue sometime later in life, there's always a good reason to start today and to do it now and to not procrastinate. I mean, procrastination is the enemy, as we say. So, start early and start often.
I thought rust was the enemy in the Navy, but it may be procrastination too.
Well, you pay paint over rust.
Exactly.
You're never looking to eliminate it.
Yeah, just chip it and paint it. But I think that's, you know, again, great advice. Too many folks say, well, geez, it's, you know, I can't do it. It's this, it's that. Nowadays in particular with online learning opportunities, there's a lot more flexibility, and you just have to eliminate the excuses, don't you?
You do, and you have to keep your goals in front of you at all times and really think critically reflect and say, what am I actually doing to pursue my goals? Am I doing anything substantive to get me closer to that goal? If the answer is no, then you need to immediately change your habits and change your mindset. As long as you're making some progress toward that goal, you will come out ahead in the long run. It's just that incremental work you have to put in.
So you met another lieutenant in the Navy who now is your business partner. Tell us how you guys met and how the goal came together to head in this direction.
That was also an evolved process, one that took form over many months at sea. As you said, there's only 30 or so officers on the Harpers Ferry as well. And Ben and I met, on standing watch together and interacting on a daily basis. Just formed a good working friendship after a while, and then started putting some ideas together for businesses. We had a really good balance, I think. I think when you pick a business partner, it's very important to have that balance to offset your skills with other skills, to offset your experience with, different experiences and unique ones. We just mesh really well together. So we had a couple ideas before this one that weren't as good, but we were overseas to cut it short. We were overseas and we saw some very lively, energetic food markets in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, and we said, why can't we do something like this in the States, but kind of Americanize it, if you will. Make it boutique, offer a strong value proposition, offer an opportunity for chefs to run their own businesses in our space, operate their own kitchens and run their own businesses, essentially set it up as an incubator, and also add this compelling customer component with a bar program and floor service. So we kind of combined a bunch of ideas together, and then went through about 20 iterations, and then came out the other side with something that ended up working.
So you've abbreviated this process and made it sound like, wow, that was pretty easy. But in there you said 20 iterations. How much time did it take before you guys sort of molded and shaped and refined your business plan for Galley Group, Inc.?
At least a year and a half, maybe more, and that's a year and a half of daily work on this. That first business plan was very different from the 20th one that we came out with, and we weren't in a vacuum. We weren't isolated in that development. We were reaching out to people who knew more than us in the Pittsburgh community. Ben had connections here, so we were constantly refining that plan. If you look at that first one, you would say, well, how's that ever going to work? And if you look at the 20th one, you might say, well, that might work with a whole lot of effort behind it. And that's essentially the path we took. But I actually haven't sat down and counted the number of hours that went into it. But I can tell you it's definitely in the hundreds, probably the thousands of hours of work into that business plan to bring all the pieces together. Now, if you had been in the industry and maybe you're smarter than us, then you could probably cut that down a little bit. But we were coming at this from very little experience in the restaurant industry, so it was a steep learning curve for us.
And Veterans Radio listeners, we're talking to Tyler Benson. He and his partner, Ben Mantica, are co-founders and co-CEOs of the Galley Group, Inc., a food hall development management and advisory company based in Pittsburgh, PA. And it's a kind of a really unique concept that, you, as you say, you pull together from things that you saw when you were overseas. But how in the world did two Navy lieutenants who had limited or no restaurant experience actually think you could pull this off?
Well, we came at it from a project management perspective. So that was one of the core functions of our jobs in the Navy. You know, when you're in port and you're doing massive ship repair projects, you're managing those. You're managing your divisions on a daily basis. So there's a lot of project management skill that you learn in the military. And we said, when we started thinking about this business and putting out these business plans, we really said, where is our competitive advantage and what are we best at? Ben and I, as the founders of the company, where are we strong and where are we weak and how can we fill in those weaknesses? And, our thesis is that, if we're giving people opportunity to run their own restaurants and we're not involving ourselves or saying that we can do this better than somebody else, then we have a real opportunity to kind of spread the risk and also spread the opportunity. Risk, that's, you know, the nature of risk and reward. So we said we will build out these kitchens, in our first two locations, four kitchens, and we will license them out to really talented chefs from some of the best restaurants who have never owned their own restaurant, who want to come in with us, put up very little capital, very little cash, essentially just enough to buy their starting inventory. We don't even have a fee, and come in and run your own business, set up your own brand, set your own menu, and operate essentially independently within our space. So we said, if we can do that, if we can find the right people to do these core functions of the restaurant, then if we bring them all together, we can have something that, you know, is perhaps more than some of its parts and actually has some brand value and has a positive customer value. We did the same thing with the bar. So we found an amazing, you know, bar program director who's still with us. His name's Tim. He's setting up all of our bar programs at each location that we're opening. And we have just an amazing staff behind us. So, to answer that question kind of in a roundabout way, we said, let's go find the best people and, bring them in to kind of the inner circle and give them ownership of what we're doing.
And so the concept is you bring in four chefs who are in charge of their own menus, but they're not going out and having to rent space. And the customers can come in and pick off any of the chef's menu items. Is that how it works?
That's right. Yeah. So, the chef runs his own restaurant, his or her own restaurant, out in the wild of the marketplace. A person might need to spend, you know, depending on where you are, $500,000 to $1 million to start a restaurant. Well, in our space, it's only going to cost a person $10,000 or $15,000. And like I said, that's only for some of the incidental startup expenses. But it's a real opportunity for them to earn profit. On the other side of it, we participate in revenue sharing with them. So they pay no rent. We just participate on a percent basis of their sales. So we collect 30% of their sales on a weekly basis.
And is the concept, Tyler, that you're finding new chefs that have not had this opportunity before, or are you finding chefs who want to leave an established restaurant and come try this on their own because they got the entrepreneurial bug? What's sort of the chef mix that you get?
That's a great question. We get applicants from kind of the full spectrum of what you just said and from all over the country. But we're really looking for local chefs who are established, who have worked in restaurants for quite a while, are in the higher echelons of the chef structure and hierarchy in a restaurant, so sous chef or executive chef, and that want to start their own place and that haven't done it before. That's like the prime candidate. And so we go through a pretty long application process, see who, you know, kind of wants it the most and who's we think is talented enough to pull it off, not just from a culinary perspective, but from a management and team leadership perspective. And we give them a shot to run their own business in our space. It's pretty unique in that sense. There are other food halls in the country, but essentially there are no other players doing it like we are.
Well, it's a great concept, and it's been tested out. You've got a couple of locations and a couple more planned. Tell us about the current plans.
So we have two locations open in Pittsburgh right now. We are opening in Cleveland in October. We're opening in Detroit in November and Chicago in March. From there, we plan to expand to other Midwestern and East Coast cities over the next couple of years. So we think there's opportunity in a whole bunch of markets for our concept.
Well, it's a great concept. I think it's borne out by the ability to expand into new markets and be very attractive in some of these growing formerly Rust Belt cities. Certainly, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Cleveland have all had their downtime, and they're all having some positive momentum now in those communities. So it's a kind of a great thing for you to ride. In terms of workforce, do you see that there are some certainly great veteran chefs, but there's also great veteran servers and bartenders? How do you see veterans fitting into this process?
Well, we always say we would love to hire all veterans. We have, from our time in the service, we have 100% respect for the work ethic that comes with military service, and the perseverance and the grit that you learn in service. If we could round everybody up and just offer them all jobs, we absolutely would. It's in the food service business, when you're looking at some of the floor staff and some of the bar staff, the veteran field is not extremely wide in that sense. And I think in some, you know, respects, it's tough to find veterans for food service jobs. But what we're seeing is, you know, a ton of opportunity to create new jobs in these, in the cities that we're going to. Every galley location is going to create between 50 and 70 jobs out of the gate. The chef businesses that are started, if they go on and start a brick and mortar out of our space and use our space as a launch pad as it's intended, then the follow-on effect of the job creation can be sort of a ripple, and we can roll them out, bring somebody else in, start a whole new business.
Is there a cycle, Tyler? Do you expect chefs to be with you for a year or two before they either move on or choose to do something else? Is there kind of a life cycle?
There is. So everyone starts with us for a year, a license agreement. And then after that time, there's a kind of a decision that's made. Those, the operator, we call them operators. Do they want to stay with us? Are they a good fit for the galley? Do we think about an extension, for a little bit longer, maybe another 6 months or maybe even another year? Or are they ready to go off on their own? Or do they realize during the process, hey, I don't want to run my own business. I actually want to go work for someone else again, which is also a good outcome for us.
Absolutely. It's a learning experience all the way around. Before we run out of time, I want to mention the Smallman Gallery, which I think was your first galley in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
So, folks, if you're in the Pittsburgh area, go to Smallman Galley. Check it out on TripAdvisor if you don't believe me, because it's got a zillion ratings. It's the number 40th restaurant out of 1,700 in Pittsburgh. So it's really well received. The photos will make you hungry too, by the way. But if folks want to know more about where you're opening, what the concept is, give me a website, something that the listeners might want to go to.
Sure. The best resource is going to be galleygrp.com. So that's galley group, without the vowels in group, galleygrp.com. And absolutely follow us on social media as well, on our Smallman Galley or Federal Galley Instagram, Twitter, Facebook feeds.
And is there a name yet for the Cleveland Galley?
There is. It will be Ohio City Galley, and that's named after the neighborhood that we're going to be in.
And how about Detroit and Chicago? Have they been named at this point?
Detroit will be Fort Street Galley, and Chicago, I can't say yet. We'll keep that under wraps.
Okay, yeah. There you go. There you go. We're going to have to keep listening and watching to find out where those that galley in particular opens up. Tyler Benson, we wish you nothing but the best as you continue to roll out this concept through the Midwest and then the East Coast. It's been great that you had a little time to share with us today on Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks so much, Jim. I appreciate it.
Okay, you need to put that one on your bucket list for dining out in at least 2019. The Detroit Galley concept is called Fort Street, F-O-R-T Street Galley. It does have a web page, fortstreetgalley.org. You can also track them on social media. But get out and support another Navy veteran in this concept. And come on back after the news to hear about John U. Bacon's book on a World War I explosion in Halifax that had tremendous effect not only in this Canadian town but across the whole theater and its special relationship with the city of Boston. And welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm Officer of the Deck today for Veterans Radio on WHAM 1600 Talk Radio. We're excited to bring to you an interview with local author John U. Bacon, who you probably know from his sports writing, but I think what you'll find very interesting about this interview is his storytelling about the Great Halifax Explosion. Before starting the interview, I'd like to thank one of our sponsors, which is the American House in Westland, Michigan on Vannoy Road. It's a great sponsor of Veterans Radio and has been for a number of years, and we want to thank them for all they do in taking care of our veterans who are residents at American House, a senior living community, which can be reached at 734-961-4782. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today John U. Bacon. John is a writer, public speaker, teacher, kind of a very well-rounded guy, and he's written a very interesting book that's now out in paperback called The Great Halifax Explosion. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, this is an interesting story, and we'll a little later on talk about the what got you interested in it, because many of the books that you've authored, 10 I think in total, tend to be more in the sports and business arena. But this book is about something most people didn't know happened in World War I, at the time of the Great War. So why don't you tell us what the Great Halifax Explosion was all about?
Sure, and of course, you're exactly right. Naturally, that most Canadians today don't even know about this, although at the time, the whole world knew about it. It was the biggest man-made explosion until Hiroshima, and it is about one-fifth the power of the A-bomb, incredibly, so that's your teaser. But to back it up, in November of 1917, the Russians get out of the Great War, of course, led by Lenin, who promised if the Bolshevik Revolution worked that they would get out of the Great War. They did. So now the Allied powers are terrified of losing the war to the Germans because they don't have an Eastern Front anymore. So what do? You overdo it. You fill up a ship, the Mont Blanc, a French munition ship in Brooklyn, in a great spot called Gravesend Bay, with 6 million pounds of high explosives. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty, so, excuse me, you're overdoing it at that point. This is not a good idea. Then that ship on the way to Europe to bomb Germans with all that explosives, it stops in Halifax for a layover. And in Halifax, it ends up in a game of chicken with another ship that has no idea what the Mont Blanc has on it. And so the two ships end up bumping into each other. The fire starts in the bow. The French crew, 40 so guys, get in the rowboat and take off the other direction, away from the population, crucially, warning no one along the way. And now the ghost ship, still on fire with all this explosives on it, it slides perfectly on its own into the Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:45 in the morning. And the timing there is crucial because that's when people are walking to work, they're walking to school, and they all want to go down and see the burning ship, having no idea, again, what's on that ship. So hundreds and thousands gather to watch the ship burn. And then at 9:04.35, we know the exact second this happened. In 1/15th of a second, the temperature of the hold of the Mont Blanc skyrockets to 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's six times hotter than molten lava. It explodes in all directions at 3,400 miles per hour. That is four times the speed of sound. And you've got basically a mini A-bomb, which creates a cauliflower cloud, if you will, almost a mushroom cloud, 2 miles high in the air. So everything around it is vaporized. The ship itself, which is as big as a football field, is vaporized. The biggest chunk we have is about a square yard, basically, of that ship is all that's left. It's gone. In that split second, you've got 25,000 Haligonians, people who live in Halifax, half the city. They're homeless. Half the city is gone. 9,000 are wounded, and 1,600 are dead instantly. Now the question is, the 9,000 wounded, how many of those can you save? And that question gets answered in the hours ahead.
And anybody who's served and been on ship knows the, which I have and many of our listeners have, knows the utter fear you have of being on a ship that catches fire, because you have very few resources to do anything, and you know, even when it's not packed with explosives, that the potential for explosion is utmost. Why in this instance did the captain of the ship, Mont Blanc, not have up either, in those days it would have been flags demonstrating that it was carrying explosive cargo, or put out the word to its pilots and others of the explosive nature of the ship?
Because the simple fear of the U-boats, you're right, of course you're dead right, that anybody who's been on a ship knows there's always a fear factor, and if there's not, you're not paying attention. Any veteran who's been on a ship, hats off, because that's automatically dangerous work. All kinds of things can happen. And that, and of course, is multiplied many times over when your ship has got 6 million pounds of explosives. What they should have done, what they did not do, of course, outside the harbor, is put up the red munitions flag, which lets everyone know that, of course, there's explosives on the ship. And that reason is simple and sound, and that is because you've got about 300 or 400 U-boats in the Atlantic at that time who have already knocked out 5,000 Allied ships, an incredibly successful rate for those ships, of course, for those U-boats. It had changed the direction of the war. The Germans were losing badly before the U-boats came along. So that was a game changer, so you had to avoid those guys. They're mostly, of course, in the English Channel and covering Europe, but quite a few were along the North American coast. So they wisely did not do that. However, they unwisely, once they're in the harbor has got not one but two fences to keep U-boats out, that line that span the harbor entrance. And these are only open in the morning and they're closed at night, so U-boats can't get in. And it worked. U-boats, there's no recording of any U-boat ever getting into Halifax Harbor during this time. As an aside, Halifax Harbor is the world's second biggest natural harbor, next only to Sydney. So this is a great place for Allied ships to reconvene, of course, to get your convoys going and whatnot. But they could have put the flag up then. If they put the flag up then the old policy of all other ships in the harbor stop when the munitions ship comes in. We would never even be talking today about the Halifax explosion. But the captain had the option of putting the flag up and chose not to. That is one in a series of deadly mistakes.
And I think one of the things, again, that military buffs often wonder about is how the hell do these Navy ships, or in this instance merchant ships, run right into each other out there in all that water?
That is a series of other mistakes.
And talk about that a little bit, because, again, in a harbor there are pilots, there are rules. These things shouldn't happen, but even now in 2018 with all the technology, we still have ships running into each other.
Exactly, which is even more incredible. It shows you human nature is human nature. These things don't happen unless people cut corners, think it does not apply to them this time. Everything looks safe. Screw it. Let's keep going and break a few rules. So that's what happens in the last 2 years. You read about these situations, of course. It happened then, too. The blame for that goes to Captain Fromm, F-R-O-M, the captain of the Norwegian supply ship called the IMO, I-M-O. That ship is empty. They're a couple days late leaving the harbor, so he's getting very anxious. The guy's a hothead. We've documented that. So he's as anxious to get out of Halifax Harbor as Mont Blanc is to get in and to get into safety. So Mont Blanc, the morning of December 6, 1917, is crawling along the right shoreline of Halifax Harbor the way it should be and following all protocols, even being on the safe side, as you might imagine. The IMO is the opposite. It's riding high. It's got nothing in it. It needs to go to New York to grab supplies to help those who've been burned and hit in the European theater. So it is dying to get out of there, of course. It is going too fast. It's got a nice big frothy bow, a wake in front of its bow, of course. You don't want that. And it's like a two-lane road, basically, where you keep on passing on the left-hand side. He's not supposed to. He's supposed to pass on the right. Keeps on passing the left-hand side again and again and again and gets farther and farther off the center line of the harbor. It works just like a two-lane road. You're supposed to stay on the right or starboard side. And he keeps on scooching over, going too fast, passing ships on the left. He's finally directly in the left-hand lane, if you will, facing Mont Blanc, about a half mile away, which is pretty close in nautical terms. So what happens when Mont Blanc sees this ship barreling down on it, going basically full blast? It can't believe it, and it throws one blast on the horn, bam, which is nautical language to, of course, IMO to say, I'm in the correct lane, I'm doing things right, I'm on the right course, I am staying my course, you must respond to me. And IMO comes back with two blasts, which essentially means, screw you, I don't care. And at that, of course, the Mont Blanc captain is aghast, he is ashen, his eyes are wide, so he does it again. One blast on the Mont Blanc horn, and then IMO comes right back again with two blasts on his horn, not slowing down, not changing direction. Excuse me. And now, of course, the Mont Blanc is panicking, and they're on a collision course. This is a game of high-stakes chicken. And what do you do in a game of high-stakes chicken? If you're in the right lane and you see a truck coming in your lane and your side full blast, sooner or later, you ignore traffic convention, the laws and whatnot, and you bail to the center of the road, which you don't want to do normally, but in this case, that's all the Mont Blanc can do. You can't go to the shore. So he goes hard to port, which is the left-hand side, of course, at the exact same second, sadly, tragically, that the IMO captain makes the same decision that, okay, I got to bail out. So they both chicken out, if you will, at the same time. They bump into each other in the middle of Halifax Harbor, not a big collision by any standard, certainly not of the time. But enough to knock over the 300 barrels of benzol airplane fuel on the bow of Mont Blanc. As carefully as they packed 6 million pounds of explosives, taking a month to do so, working 24 hours a day, lining your boots with canvas so there are no sparks, using only copper nails to line the hold, because that is a metal that does not spark when struck. They've been very, very careful to line this with rubber and sealer and canvas and whatnot to make sure that the packages don't jostle, which can itself throw up a high explosive. After all that, they put 300 barrels of benzol airplane fuel on the top. It is the perfect fuse, sadly. So that knocks over, the fire starts, and then, of course, the French crew takes off for the northern shore, which is Dartmouth, instead of going to the south, where Halifax is and the population is. So no one's been warned. The ship is on fire. And we know what happens next.
Yeah, there's about 20 minutes where the ship is drifting because of a captain calls for abandoned ship. and it's drifting on fire before the explosion occurs. And as you've said, this explosion vaporizes the ship. It vaporizes all kinds of individuals with, 1,600 immediately killed. Many more die in the afterwards, many injured. And we're talking men, women, children, those who have just come back from war because they're in Halifax, because Halifax is such an important port for not only Canadian shipping, but American shipping and shipping all around the world at that point in time. It's a calamity on the level of what's going on in the Great War over in Europe with the amount of folks who are dead. Were the Canadians prepared for this?
No, and probably nobody could have been. And of course, you're right. Sadly, the ratio is Titanic. 5 years earlier, of course, it crashed in the North Atlantic. Halifax, the closest harbor that had train service across the continent. Newfoundland is St. John's, and Newfoundland is closer, but you couldn't get, if you took the victims there, you couldn't get them around North America. So 300 or so victims were found from a Halifax rescue crew working quite diligently to find the bodies out there, horrible work and dangerous work. And they were sent around from Halifax in 1912, embalmed and sent to wherever their homes were. 300 or so were buried in Halifax. It is the biggest gravesite for Titanic victims. So they were ready for that, amazingly, but they were not ready for this. And the ratios of this tragedy were the opposite of the Titanic ratios. Titanic, of course, mainly the men died because women and children largely were put on first on the rescue boats. In this case, it's the opposite. The men are off to war. They're, of course, in France, they're in Ypres, and they're in the worst kind of trench warfare. Their wives and their kids are back at home, and they're in Halifax. So they are the ones come down to the harbor to watch this thing burn and then explode. So the tragedy is multiplied somewhat by the victims themselves. They were not ready for this, and of course now half your town is gone anyway. So even if you were ready for this, half of it's gone regardless. And that's where, of course, Halifax is lucky to get help from Boston.
Well, and I think this is a good example of how history ripples through time. And we're talking to John U. Bacon, the author of The Great Halifax Explosion, which is now out in paperback from William and Morrow. John, you can hear echoes of the 9/11 planes flying into the World Trade Center in New York, and that kind of mass destruction and unpreparedness when you read the story that you wrote, well, or report. It's not a story. It's reporting what happened. Did you feel those echoes through time as you were writing?
Absolutely. I think that if I had not lived through 9/11, my sense of this would have been utterly foreign. But having seen a cataclysm happen out of nowhere, it seems, now that was, of course, intentional. Obviously, that was terrorism, not a dumb, bad accident. But you see also the few things paralleled it, I think. One is the safety nets that were in place to avoid this kind of thing were taken away one by one. Some signs were ignored. We know that about 9/11. After it happens, of course, the sheer shock and breadth of it are mind-blowing. It's, you can't get your head around it. That's very parallel to Halifax. And then what happens next is also parallel to Halifax, and that is how, in Le Monde, the French paper, of course, we are all Americans after 9/11. That was a sense after Halifax. The entire world was engaged. This thing bumped off the Great War, World War I, off the front pages of the world's newspapers across the world. This is the main news for a week, despite the fact that, of course, as much killing or more was happening overseas.
And it, so also changed, and I want to, before we run out of time, I want you to talk about, it seemed to me it also changed the Canadian-U.S. relationships, and you mentioned Boston in particular, but Boston's part of this larger view that Canadians had of the U.S. and the U.S. had of the Canadians before this event. talk to us through how that, again, sort of changed things, changed world views, certainly changed country views. And I, again, sort of recognize ripples through time as we're Canada and the U.S. are having certain issues in the trade wars.
Right, and that's one of the great things of the book. The first half of the book is setting up the tragedy itself. The second half is the part that will make you glad to be a human being and reassure your faith in humanity. Because, first of all, in Halifax, individuals helped out individuals, strangers helped strangers, risking their own lives oftentimes, sacrificing greatly for each other. Of the 9,000 wounded, it turns out, very few were killed. And you'd think that many of them would have died after that fact, but Halifax helped out tremendously. People there, Canada itself mobilized, but more surprising was the help from Boston. And my mom was Canadian, so I got a better sense of this, but I was still shocked by this, and so was she, how much we were not allies before 1917, U.S. and Canada, that is. Of course, we fought against each other in 1776. We fought against each other again in 1812. In the Civil War, Canada was officially neutral, but the people in Halifax supported the South, because that's where they got the cotton from, which they processed in Halifax and shipped it around the world. In 1911, this I know came as a shock to you, the Speaker of the House of the U.S. Congress, the Paul Ryan of his day, took to the floor of the U.S. Congress to advocate for the violent overthrow of Canada to annex it. This is in 1911, and he received loud cheers and a fine write-up in the Washington Post. Are you kidding me? So we are not allies at this point, and yet Boston sees fit after they catch wind of what had happened in Halifax and not really knowing a lot about it. Without being prompted, they sent two trains, two ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, and $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million a day, big money, all without being asked, not even being asked whatsoever, and got them through the worst snowstorm in 10 years up to Halifax. And that is what saved Halifax. Of the 9,000 wounded, only 400 died. Less than 5%. That is an incredibly successful ratio, one we'd be lucky to match in Puerto Rico and other sites of tragedies lately. So that's an amazing success rate. And whenever people talk to the people of Halifax, the survivors, 60, 70 years later, the first thing all of them mention, and these are people who lost, you know, four siblings, their parents, their home, had, you know, gigantic losses, personally and otherwise. The first thing all of them mentioned was the help from Boston, and they almost always became teary-eyed when they mentioned it. This is what makes the U.S. and Canada allies. And for the last century and 1 year, they have been by far our biggest trading partner for the U.S. Germany, Japan, and China combined buy about what export, about what Canada does from the U.S. every single day.
Well, that part of the story, again, is something that isn't taught in your schools. You're not going to get from anybody else. This really opened my eyes in that regards, John, and I think you did a great job communicating the before view of the countries and how they came together. And I want to remind our veteran radio listeners that we're talking about a period of time when there are no cell phones, there is no internet, there's no cable TV. You know, Boston rose to the challenge out of their humanity from teletypes, from poor communications. They just knew they had to do a monumental effort, and they did that without government funding. They did that from the generosity of their heart and their wallets, didn't they?
They did. In fact, they had set up a relief crew for this purpose, because they were now in the war too, of course, even before the U.S. entered the war in April of 1917, which is only, you know, 5-6 months earlier. Boston was already mobilized for, because they knew that U-boats were off their coast, and if they get into the war, this could happen, something like this could happen. So they had already set up an amazing response system for a tragedy like this, thinking that, you know, it could happen to them. They did not know it would happen to somebody else, so they mobilized this for their would-be foes, if you will, ancient foes is what somebody called it, across the harbor in Halifax, and out of the goodness of their heart, with no expectation of being paid back, with no quid pro quo, and it must be said, they got there before the people of Toronto, Ottawa, Quebec City, Montreal, any of those got there, the people from Boston got there first. And that has left a permanent impression on Halifax, so much so that to this day, Every year they spend $180,000 of taxpayer money in Nova Scotia to find the greatest Christmas tree in the province, usually a 50-foot spruce. They chop it down in a big ceremony. They load it up on a truck. They have another ceremony in Halifax. These people can drink, by the way. It's the drinkingest town in Canada, it turns out, which gets my attention. And they take it down to Boston to put in their in the Boston Commons, the oldest park in the United States from 1634. And they celebrate Christmas again to thank them for the help they sent to Halifax 101 years ago. And when I pointed out to one of them that, you know, I have to tell you, most folks in Boston have no idea who gives the tree and why, a Halifax official said, I don't see any reason why we should stop thanking them, which is a beautiful sentiment on both sides of the pond. And the relief committee set up in 1917 out of Boston involved no public funds whatsoever. It's privately raised. So the whole story is quite incredible.
Well, and I want to come back, and you mentioned in passing that your mother's Canadian. I've read that your grandfather, I assume her father, was Canadian and told this story a little bit. It piqued your interest. But there was also another unique hook to this story for you, which we'll just touch on briefly, and that's Joseph Bars, who was a Canadian soldier who fought in the Great War, who was severely injured both in his back and his foot. Mentally, today we'd call it PTSD. He came back to Halifax area, ended up volunteering with a doctor to go to Halifax and work as sort of a team to aid the injured. Tell us the rest of the story.
Sure. I got lucky in that one. I found out about the story through my grandfather, who was 12 years old, living in New Brunswick, adjoining province, when this happened. And then I heard about it again when I was interviewing the son of Joseph Bars, also Joseph Bars, who was a doctor in his 80s at that time. This is in the 1990s. I interviewed him because his dad had founded the Michigan Hockey Program, which I was writing about at the time. So as he tells me the story, I'm thinking, man, I've heard this before. And I dug into it and I realized, this is the great Halifax explosion my grandfather told me about. So as I'm learning more about Joseph Bars, I was gratified to learn that he wrote beautiful letters throughout his life, and they've got them. And that was the key thread throughout the entire story, kind of like Forrest Gump. Wherever my story went, Joseph Bars happened to be there. So he grows up in Nova Scotia, a four sports star in college, graduates with a bachelor's degree at age 19, so he's a brainiac too, goes to Montreal to make his fortune, but he's not fulfilled. Business is not doing it for him. The Great War breaks out. He enlists with his friends in 1915, gets sent over to the worst fighting in the world has ever seen to that point. And he's writing his letters. At first he's all gung-ho, and then he realizes a year later he wants out. It's like Vietnam. It's not getting anywhere. The spirit has been lost. Then he gets hit by a mortar and flown across the field. They think he's dead. He's not dead. They manage to get him off the field 2 days later. His left leg is so badly damaged they assume that he can't walk again and has got some spinal issues. While he's recovering in Halifax, the explosion happens. And he's got no real medical training beyond first aid, but that's enough. It's all hands on deck. So Joseph Bars spends 3 days performing surgeries without anesthesia for 3 days, no sleep. And during that time, then Boston comes to relieve him 3 days later, and that's when he realizes what great allies the Americans were. He was very anti-American before this happened. In that process, also, he realized he does not want to be a soldier or a hockey player or a businessman or a pastor like his dad. He wants to be a doctor and do the healing. So he decides to go to medical school. His uncle gives him $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan, and we have no idea why. But he did. And in 1919, he arrives in Ann Arbor and starts taking the prereq courses to become a doctor. He passes those. While he's doing this, he's skating every day at the indoor rink, trying to relearn how to walk, basically. He skates every day till the tears come down his face, but he's a tough guy, and he keeps fighting through it. And finally, he goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the legendary athletic director, and says, you need a hockey program. And he says, you're right, but only if you're the first coach. And that is how Michigan got hockey, and that's how I grew up playing hockey in that rink. So, small world.
It is a good example of how we are all interconnected, whether we realize it or not. And, John U. Bacon, I want to thank you for taking time to talk to our veteran radio listeners today about your national bestseller, The Great Halifax Explosion, which is now out in paperback on a William Morrow imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. John, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. A real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed these interviews on Veterans Radio. They had a definite flair, I think. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook. You can listen to our podcast there as well. You can track Veterans Radio at veteransradio.net, which is the easiest way to get to our podcast and our live 365 broadcast. But we always want you coming back here to WHAM 1600 AM every Sunday evening to listen to our stories and our interviews, and let us know what you'd like to hear, if you've got some story ideas or people we should interview. And until next time, you are dismissed.